Good evening, everybody.
It's nice to be here from parts unknown. I took a little bit of a trip, and I am not at NJR North. Staying with some family in my home state of New Jersey, and it's nice to be back. I'm vaccinated. Yesterday was 420. It's a good day. It's a good day. I'm going to talk a little bit about it, but there's a lot going on. Of course, we have to thank our editorial board here at Revolution Radio for bringing you this fine program we call NJRR Live. And my name is Brian Powers. We bring you around the world of grassroots activism. We talk about art. We talk about anti-capitalist work. We talk about politics and anything else that comes along our revolutionary circles. And it's all supported by you, the people that listen to us, the grassroots activists that are out there organizing every day for the causes that we all care about. So thanks a lot for tuning in. And we're here every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. We have been for about 3 years now. And I'm really proud of what we've built. And just a few weeks ago, of course, we brought in Daryl Lamont Jenkins and the Ida Vox Report. So now we do two shows here on the Revolution Radio Network. And I hope that all of you will tune in to the Ida Vox Report podcast coming soon. But the live stream is out there on our YouTube channel and, you know, all our social medias and stuff. Check it out. We get into it about what, you know, of course, the trial of the man who killed George Floyd there in Minneapolis. And I have tried to make a commitment when we talk about racial justice is to more to lean into celebrating life, celebrating culture, celebrating people for who they are. And I think there have been some attempts at that in the case of George Floyd and celebrating him as a father and a man, you know, who's part of a community who had people that loved him on this earth. And I would prefer to do that than to make the disgusting comments such as Nancy Pelosi made. And for those of you that hadn't heard what she said, she talked about how George Floyd was sacrificed. I do not want black men being sacrificed on the streets for anybody, for any reason. And her statements just continue to show how out of touch the establishment is with the current reality and the politics of today. We still have Clinton era neoliberals clearly running our government, and it was reflected in some of those comments, which I'm not going to repeat or give a lot of time to here. All I will say is it's not my thoughts. My thoughts are with George Floyd's family, because they, you know, they're not going to get George back. And, you know, regardless of what the sentence is, and I don't hearing in what the sentence might be, what guidelines are and what's taken into account, you know, I've made the commitment to not be surprised by anything that happens. And I don't think anybody should be surprised by anything that happens. It's helped keep me level-headed about the whole situation, I think. And I'll just continue to take that attitude with the sentencing and just, you know, try to talk about the good things about having a diverse country, because there's enough struggle and strife out there, and we're committed to art and activism here. So you know, I think I'd rather talk about music and sculpture and things that come out of your community rather than the people being murdered. I just feel that's a more positive outlook. Although I'm never ever going to ignore or understate the issues that go on with policing. That's what tonight's show is going to be all about. We're going to start off talking about qualified immunity, a term that you may have heard with our editorial board member, who's an attorney out of New Jersey, Bennett Zarofsky, and that will lead into the wider conversation about police accountability. So we're not going to ignore that issue, but at the same time, I'm going to say George Floyd's name. And I'm going to say them, you know, as a way of celebrating their life and not their death. As I stated a second ago, and I do encourage one more time to check out the Ida Vox report, because we did talk about this a lot more in depth just the other night.
I came into New Jersey and it was basically to visit family. And I did not put out there on even on my Facebook that I was coming home or not, because I honestly didn't know if I was going to do anything worth putting out there or letting people know. But, you know, it was 4:20 and I did have some clear time. So I headed down to a Trend State House to see some old friends and some enemies and smoke a little weed and maybe make a little trouble. And when I first got down there, I started out, I brought about a half ounce of grass with me, and I meant to stop somewhere and get some little containers so I could give out, you know, little buds to some friends and people on the street or whatever. And unfortunately, the place where I stopped to get some containers was closed. So I walked up to the state house and I just started handing out some buds and it was nice. A lot of people came out of the woodwork and a lot of people were really happy to get some free weed on 420. So that was fun. And I made some friends that way. By the time I had gotten to the state house and saw the Sativa Cross, that works out in New Jersey as an advocacy group, had a little bit of a session in front of the state house. It was more or less of the corporate cannabis scene, although I don't want to offend anybody that was there that is a grassroots activist, because there's a mix of people there. But I did see, you know, some people that are trying to get into the licensing programs and set their way into this new market where we have legalized cannabis in New Jersey. And then, you know, it was very corporate. There wasn't even a lot of people smoking weed. I felt like I was the only one smoking a joint out there. I mean, I did do a couple of dabs with some friends and I hung around for about an hour, but it really, you know, they had some music going, but I went around, saw everybody was, you know, hawking their CBD wares and selling their kind of legal products and advocacy groups were there as well. And so it was okay. So I spent about an hour there and I kind of got bored with the scene. So say goodbye to the comrades and marched down the street to a black market pop-up where they sell, you know, weed out in the open. And it was really nice. It was an outdoor setup and they had some tables set up and there were vendors selling different forms of cannabis and edibles and blunts and pre-rolls and all kinds of stuff. It was really a lot like what I'm used to in my new home state of Maine, or what you see in maybe California, Colorado, Oregon, and these states where there's a lot of products, you know, and this is all illegal stuff. But, you know, I took a look around to observe the marketplace, of course, for journalistic purposes. And, you know, I had a good time. I smoked some weed with some more comrades and hung out for way longer than an hour. And I had something to eat and took in some good music and we laughed and it was nice to catch up. And it was just a way, way different experience and then had the one I had a few blocks down at the kind of political corporate gig, right? So I kind of had like this view of these two worlds of cannabis that are forming around us as we get into legalization. And it was a very interesting few hours of my life, because it was almost like being in two worlds for one day, you know. And it really started to crystallize for me the difference between what potheads want in legalization and what people that use cannabis for medical purposes want, and what this government and what the corporations who are controlling legalization want, because they're two very different things. And one of these arguments out there, and you probably heard this even from some lefty circles, that we can't call cannabis marijuana anymore. And I get this. This guy Anslinger, who initiated prohibition years ago, did in fact use the term marijuana to associate with Mexican immigrants and associate that with crime and bad activity. It was used. It does have racist roots. It's true. So I can't argue with history. But I did read, I've been reading that we can use it when we use the term medical marijuana. So you can still use it if you call it medical marijuana. And the only other acceptable term is cannabis. Now, this is the corporate mantra now. If you look and when you look at branding and you hear the people and you look carefully at who's doing this, it's kind of being put out by people. Why? They want to change the culture, right? What's the point of, you know, changing what we term, what the terms that we use, or the point, the language is intended for them to take over that culture by using their own language, by using their own terminology. And they've deemed cannabis as the only term that you can use and be acceptable in society. And they, and then they can claim that term and use it for their marketing purposes. Right. But, you know, we all know, those of us that smoke pot, call it marijuana, weed, grass, ganja, we've got devil's lettuce, bud, chronic reefer, skunk, Mary Jane. We've all crawled our drug dealer and asked for some weird shit like, hey, man, you know, I need to get some notebooks or Yankees tickets, or I need to buy a bottle of water. We've all got our codes, right? So pot has been called just about every fucking thing on the face of this earth. But what we're really seeing, you know, in these two worlds is the idea that, you know, we can only use certain acceptable terms. And it's ridiculous. You see this between the two worlds, right? And on the corporate side, on the legalization side, they have a very, very big need to maintain both the police and the corporate state. They, through their regulations and their economic policies and all this kind of stuff, they are refusing to diminish police power. They are not. In fact, they're on the opposite side of social justice, despite what they put out in their PR, and despite their statements to the contrary. They can say they're for social justice all they want, but we all know that a large corporation like Curaleaf, which is run by scumbags, only seeks profit. They don't seek a better product. They don't seek social justice. That's not why a corporation gets together. A bunch of rich white dudes don't get together and say, let's help black men out of prison. When the fucking history has that ever happened? You think a bunch of large corporations run by wealthy white people out of Wall Street have got social justice on their mind first? They've got profit on their mind first. They're capitalists, man. Well, what does the pothead want? What do we want? What are the people that use this product? We want cheap weed. We want good, cheap weed. We want to be able to grow our own weed. The world we want is more closely associated and even goes further than like the craft brewer market, where you can buy your own barley and hops and make your own stuff in your basement. I want to be able to grow my own seed. I want to grow my own plants, make my own hybrids. Screw with genetics. Garden, just like I do with tomatoes or grapes or raspberries or anything else that we can garden legally in the world. Corporate world wants me to go to a store, pay $60 to $75 an eighth plus tax. And if I go outside that system, they're going to lock me up and maybe even lock me up longer than they would have before legalization. Because some of these laws that are passing include stricter laws on black market cannabis. Not easier ones. And none of them are talking about taking out our comrades out of prison. Oh, well, maybe they're talking about it. But that's about all they're going to do, right? This strict control by them, it isolates and it condenses this market. And ultimately, it hurts everybody. And it hurts something that's near and dear to me as well as science. And one of the things I've been trying to bring up more and more when I talk about cannabis is not just the social justice aspect, which to me is the number one priority in this, and making sure that our comrades get out of prison is number one in all this. But also on that list of important shit is the lack of medical research and the lack of legitimate science done on the magic herb. It's got medicinal properties, but I'm always hesitant to tell people that, hey, man, this stuff helps pain, this helps that, this helps this, because I don't know the science behind it, and there's not many doctors into it. And you've kind of got to self-medicate, which I think of as dangerous. Even though you can't die, you can't overdose, and listen, ain't nothing wrong with smoking a joint if you like smoke weed. I'm just saying, if you're using it as medicine, I would much rather have a large, wide-open world of experimentation and legitimate science done unrestrained by stupid laws telling me what kind of cannabis is best for my condition and creating new medicine. You know, new ways of treating different diseases. It's out there. It's been proven that it can be more. We've already seen plenty of research into both CBD and THC and THCA and all that different kind of stuff out there. There's so many different, you know, different letters. I probably can't get into all of them today. But, I mean, we already know that there is medicinal properties. We should know more. But prohibition's got to end. It's got to also end in the right way. Because the way we're ending it in most of these states, and what I fear is when Joe Biden gets wind of this, because I don't think he's heard that pot's legal yet. I'm not even sure if he's ever heard the term pot. He's just catching up on a lot. So, you know, we'll see. But my fear is, you know, the model being put forth in these states was a dangerous one. I just want to make some of these problems even worse. And so what's the point of legalization if we continue to exacerbate these social justice issues and putting people in prison? There's no point. Might as well just go, as New Jersey weed man says, go, you know, he's selling weed like he's white. He's got a reality show. He's opening up new places in Florida. I mean, he's telling you to just break the law. And people are going to continue to take that attitude and do those things unless you legalize correctly. And by my standards and by most pothead standards, they're fucking it up. But, you know, what else is new? What else is new? Absolutely nothing is new. I am going to bring in now, because I'm all out of breath. That was a long monologue today, so I'm going to need some help. And so I'm going to bring in Belisha Beacon out of Florida. How are you, sister?
Hello. I'm great. Thank you.
You have to talk a little bit. I'm out of this all. I'm getting old.
Deep breaths.
You were in last month talking about a horror movie, and I didn't participate in that.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
You're not a horror movie fan. I get it.
I just can't. I can't see myself watching that movie. But you were so kind as to flip through the catalogs out there, and you found another movie that I did take a look at the other night, and I enjoyed it, and I'll talk a little more in depth of my thoughts on it. But tell us about this Nomadland and why you kind of brought it up as something we should check out.
It's got a 94% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It's nominated for Best Picture. Oscars are this Sunday night. You can stream it on Hulu if you want to watch it. It's based on the book called Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century by Jessica Bruder, who is a fellow Jerseyan. And it's starring Frances McDormand and a cast of non-actors and real-life nomads who are also featured in the book. Mm. The plot is based around Fern, who's a widower in her 60s, who loses everything in the Great Recession of 2008. And she embraces life on the road, living out of her van and taking odd jobs as she travels the American West. So I thought this was a great anti-capitalist movie review because it touches on a lot of different subjects. One of them being Amazon, which was kind of surprising to me. Now, the movie kind of glosses over this aspect, but the book goes into great detail about it. I didn't know this, but researching for the movie, I found out that Amazon actually has a program called Camper Force. They, of course, they love this. They're kind of taking advantage of this right. situation where people, you know, the main character, who's a fictional character, she loses her husband. Also, the town that she lives in is completely shut down. It's one of these towns out in the middle of nowhere.
Empire.
Empire, right? It's the entire town exists because of this one company, who then shutters its doors, and then the entire town disappears. And so, you know, she's not left with a lot of resources, and she's kind of already living out of her van, and she's pushed into this lifestyle, but then winds up embracing it. So I'm sure you have a lot to say about Amazon.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I don't know that I need to continue to kick that dead horse, but overall, I liked the movie, like I said at the beginning, and just so you know, people that kind of get an idea of the feel of the picture, there's not a lot of dialogue in it. There's a lot of telling story through picture and sound, so I think if you're into both the display lighting and set design and things,
it's
like
beautiful.
That, I think a lot of it hits home, and it hits that stuff on the nose. I think some of the writing was a little off. You know, to me, some of the characters felt a little poorly written, but I could tell the difference between the characters and kind of these other people that were filmed who had lived this life. There was definitely a feel difference,
right? Yeah.
In the acted scenes versus the scenes. And one of those genuine people is the leader of that, this group. And I don't know that I wrote his name down in the notes, but she goes out to the desert at a certain point to kind of learn this van life. And there's this guru who does YouTube videos and runs this little class. And of course, right away, I feel a kinship with this guy because he's essentially organizing poor people. And
right.
In the lead up to it, you know, you kind of, it made me wonder myself, like, what is she getting into? Is she getting into a situation where people are going to be taking advantage of her because of this? Or, you know, but it really does turn out to be a support group run by this man who talks to them not only about, you know, like how to fix tires or pee in a bucket in a manner, but also a little bit of philosophy. I got a little clear I wanted to play. This is when she goes out to the desert and starts hearing this guy talk.
Okay.
Now, the odd thing is that we not only accept the tyranny of the dollar, the tyranny of the marketplace, we embrace it. We gladly throw the yoke of the tyranny of the dollar on and live by it our whole lives. I think of an analogy as a workhorse, the workhorse that is willing to work itself to death and then be put out to pasture. And that's what happens to so many of us. If society was throwing us away and sending us the workhorse out to the pasture, we workhorses had to gather together and take care of each other. And that's what this is all about.
So you can understand why that speaks to me. I'm sure if you know that, you know, I like to organize and get with people, but it's also got some libertarian bent to it. There's an American flag flying, and when he talks about the tyranny of the dollar, it certainly sounds a little bit like Ron Paul to me.
Yeah.
I think, you know, these are people who are for better or worse, trying to escape the life that capitalism has assigned them, you know, and the movie does a very, very good job of explaining that has good and bad to it. She's living in a van, she's peeing in a bucket, but she can also have breakfast on these cliffs and grill out a little bit and take in different scenery and have these different moments with different people that she meets on the road. And that guy talks about that a little bit. So I think it's, I don't know how I it was one of those movies where I didn't know how to feel about it exactly.
Yeah, there's definitely,
I think it was very trying to be honest about what was going on in their lives.
You know? There's definitely good and bad. There's pros and cons. The capitalist version of that lifestyle is the Instagram posts, the travel blogs, taking advantage of, you know, romanticizing this lifestyle. And, you know, these people have GoFundMes so that they can finish their, you know, converted school bus with these updated, you know, luxury finishes, and it looks beautiful. And, you know, and then they take these gorgeous pictures, which the movie also shows this gorgeous scenery, you know, and it's someone, you know, sipping their coffee and, you know, their toes are overlooking some beautiful sunset and some, you know, majestic land somewhere. But the other side of that is these corporations like Amazon and other companies that take advantage of this gig labor, temporary labor, they love that aspect because they don't have to, the workers don't stay there long enough to unionize, and they don't have to pay them very well. They know that their costs are low. They just kind of give them a little stipend.
One thing they didn't explain is they probably work through contractors, so they're not even considered employees, most of them.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, of course they love this. They don't have to give them rights or benefits. And one of the main characters in the book and the movie, Linda May. In the book, she's quoted as saying that Amazon is, quote, probably the biggest slave owner in the world, unquote, and says in the book, I hate this fucking job. But the movie completely ignores that part. In the movie, all the scenes at Amazon are prefaced with a safety meeting and the employee stretching and, you know, the reality is a lot of these people, because they're elderly, they wind up with a lot of serious injuries and sometimes even die.
Yeah. It's my wife did work there for a very short period of time, did like a graveyard shift, you know, it had a detrimental impact on your entire family life, and she got paid under $15 an hour for it. I mean, it really and was never made more than 30 hours because that would have given her benefits under the law, you know. So, you know, it's really ridiculous that we still get away with this in this country, but you know, it's. And we just saw the unionization effort in Alabama fail, you know. So I don't think people, and since I come from a background of advocating for worker rights, I think this country very poorly understands how little they have in the way of workers' rights anymore. I mean, you really don't. People need to understand first of all what it means to be an at-will employee and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of legal. It's complicated mess. I just got done doing a book. Book on tape that I read in the past called The Supreme Court on Unions, and it's dry and boring as all hell, but it does explain pretty clearly that labor law is useless. I could sum up the whole book in that sentence. Labor law is useless, and Amazon knows it.
There's always a way to get around it.
There is, and so that's a whole nother show that we are thinking about doing probably next month, given what went on at Amazon. So it was a very timely pick, and I kind of, as always, I wish I had more time to talk about this movie because, you know, I thought it was good. Overall, I gave it, we have a five-fist rating system that we're coming up with.
Okay,
we're going to have to come up with some graphics or something, so we'll work on that, and if people want to contribute to Revolution Radio or become editorial board members, you know, maybe you could join a bit of a group that does more reviews, because I like this. I'm enjoying these conversations, and I think it goes a long way, and in taking, you know, what's out there and giving it a revolutionary spin. So thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
I just want to say one little thing about this movie. It's a blend of documentary style and fiction, which I really enjoyed. And I think that it's going to become a legit genre in the future. So watch out for that.
I think that's where it got weird for me. I think I need to see. That's where it felt like it interrupted the flow a little bit. So that's why it only got three fists from me. How many fists did it get from you?
I'm going to give it four fists.
Four fists. Nice.
Four fists, yeah.
Very good rating. So 3.5 total. If you watch this movie, let us know. Message us on Instagram or on Facebook. Certainly, we're happy to have you, you know, jump in. And like I said, you can contribute to the editorial board if you'd like. We've got, you know, and you can, you know, have these reviews with us. You're going to stick around, right? And you're going to talk about police accountability with us?
Yes, I have a lot of questions.
Well, I do, too. I don't know that we're going to like a lot of the answers, but real quick, let's do a commercial break. So this episode of Revolution Radio, as all episodes on Revolution Radio, are brought to you by our editorial board. And I just spoke about it just a minute ago. Our friend Belicia is a member. Bennett, who's about to come on, is a member. I am a member. Leah is a member. Everybody pretty much who you start to see on this network is helping support this by contributing. And not just in a few dollars every month. It's $25 a month. And it helps pay our staff. Helps pay our standing bills, and we're doing really, really well as far as starting to even expand a little bit because of contributions from our editorial board. So they all, if I haven't thanked them personally on the phone, which I try to do, I'm going to thank them now on the air, and I'm going to do that more and more. So please consider joining the editorial board, chipping in money, ideas. I mean, really, we need it all, and it's been working pretty well the last couple months, so I can't wait to see you there. Right. I'm going to bring in Bennett Zarofsky now here, an attorney at law out of Montclair, New Jersey, or Newark? Where are you out of, Bennett?
For the last year and a half, Montclair. For over 30 years out of Newark. But we lost our lease, and I separated from the lawyers I was with and moved into Montclair with another labor attorney.
All right. Well, we are glad to have you, regardless of where your office is located. We're really glad to have you and proud of you being on our editorial board. And we brought you in here today for your law expertise in something that we may have been hearing a lot if you've been paying attention to the news and the discussions surrounding the trial of the man who killed George Floyd. We've heard a lot about qualified immunity, which basically gives people a free pass if they break the law. But I didn't know a lot about it, so I talked to you, and you were grateful, thankfully enough for us, you come on the air today to explain what qualified immunity is. So, Bennett, what's qualified immunity?
Well, qualified immunity is a doctrine invented by the United States Supreme Court in interpreting the Maine Civil Rights Enforcement Statute, which is known as Section 1983. And it's important to understand that it is not an interpretation of the Constitution. It is an interpretation of a statute, which is the only statute or the primary statute passed by Congress to enforce the United States Constitution. There's an ongoing controversy in the law as to whether there is any way to enforce your constitutional rights that would yield money damages. In general, the view of the courts traditionally has been is that there's not a common law right of action. But after the Civil War and when Reconstruction was going the way it was supposed to go, Congress passed the Civil Rights Amendments, of which 1983 is the best known. So it's a statute, which means that what the Supreme Court has invented with the qualified immunity doctrine is something that can be changed by Congress. It can also be changed by state legislatures, and to some extent, maybe even by municipal legislatures, by passing their own statutes, which have different standards and would not govern this. And, of course, the court itself could change its doctrine. Now, the idea for qualified immunity, it began with the idea, which perhaps has some merit to it, which is that police officers are often in situations where it's not clear to anybody what would be a constitutional act or what would not be a constitutional act. And they may take actions in good faith, which is where the doctrine began, which might seem reasonable to them, or they might even take actions that are mandated by other laws, because there might be an unconstitutional statute that they're asked to enforce, and that they should not necessarily be held liable in those instances. So although, beginning in a case in 1917, the court had held that there are no defenses. If you are responsible for a violation of the Constitution, if you commit a constitutional violation and someone is injured, well, then you're liable to them in money damages. And that's the law in almost every other area, that if you violate the law and someone is injured, you got to pay damages. The classic example is the car accident that we're all familiar with. You're negligent. You make a small mistake. You didn't mean to hurt anybody, but you ended up hurting somebody. Well, you're liable for that. You can be sued. And that's the end of the story. It doesn't matter why you were negligent. or your intention had nothing to do with it. So that was bad enough. It had some roots in the common law doctrine for false arrest, which had a good faith exception for officers of the law. But it grew like Topsy.
Yeah.
Once it started, it kept transmogrifying. So it reached a point where it's today. Transmogrifying, yes.
Oh, it doesn't matter now. Full stop. What the hell are you? What is transmogrifying?
Oh. It's changing its shape. It keeps changing its shape.
That isn't even a law school word, I don't think. That's
it's just there? An English word.
Write that down.
So it changed its shape so that even bad faith conduct might be protected now. Because what it says is that you're only liable if you can establish that the law is clearly established as to what the Constitution means. So this requires you, and in some circuits it's worse than others. Circuit courts are the way the federal appeals courts are divided around the country. And under our law, when the Supreme Court says something, it applies everywhere. But then the Supreme Court can't decide every case. Circuit courts cover large regions of the country, each one of them. And if they declare a constitutional precedent, that's binding on all the courts, all the federal courts below them, not necessarily the state courts, but the federal courts below them. And they're not bound by the decisions of other circuit courts. And it's not unusual for circuit courts to disagree with each other, for example. And it's also, they interpret their own precedents in different ways. And sometimes two panels of the same circuit court come up with decisions that are not exactly alike. So the law now has become that you can't sue under Section 1983 unless you can tell that the individual actor was violating clearly established constitutional doctrine.
Very hard to prove.
Well, not only that, you can ask attorneys as to whether a doctrine is clearly established, and they'll disagree with each other.
Right.
And of course, the police officers don't read every case that comes down. Their training is terrible. But before you ask me a question, it got even worse than that. At first, the Supreme Court said, first the courts below are supposed to decide whether there was a constitutional violation. And only after they decide that do they go to the question of whether it was clearly established. You got that? So at first they have to declare at least whether this conduct violated the Constitution. And then maybe they give it clearly established. But then the Supreme Court turned around and said, well, that's not necessary because we think these should be handled on a dismissal stage. And you really can't decide whether it really violated the Constitution until you know all the facts. But you can determine whether the theory has been clearly established based on what the allegations are in the complaint. So now the courts decide whether it's clearly established, and they don't have to decide whether it actually violates the Constitution. So nothing ever becomes clearly established in some circuits. Now, some circuits are much worse than other circuits because when the court first said it, the Supreme Court first said that, they indicated that the courts should pass on the question of whether, if these facts are true, is that going to be a constitutional violation? But now they don't even have to decide that. It's, some circuits are terrible. So things never get to be clearly established.
So in practice, they don't really ever get anywhere with these cases.
You never get anywhere. And some courts are ridiculous in how finely they draw the distinction as to what's clearly established. So that there have been cases, for example, where a police officers raid a backyard party, tell everyone to get on the ground. There are kids there. There's a dog there. The dog, of course, doesn't know how to listen to police officers' orders. And the dog is rather excited. So the police officer, instead of asking the people, can you please calm your dog down or something like that, tries to shoot the dog. But instead of shooting the dog, the police officer misses and kills a kid.
This is exactly the case I was thinking about.
Killing that kid, a constitutional violation. Well, the court that had it says, well, it's not clearly, you see, there is fairly clear law that if a police officer is legitimately shooting his weapon and, you know, it hits someone else, that that person who gets hit, the innocent victim, his constitutional rights haven't been violated because the police officer was acting constitutionally in firing the gun at the time. And we could talk about whether it is ever legitimate means, but just put right. that aside. So the question, so the court says, well, it's not clearly established in this sort of instance whether this child would have a, his constitutional rights were violated, because we don't have anything to do with shooting a dog or something. I mean, it's just a ridiculous distinction. And then they never reached a question, which maybe is a legitimate question as to whether it violated the Constitution or not. But they don't even bother to reach it.
Right.
You know, so it gets to be a very ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
And then if you prevail on that appeal, the last thing the Supreme Court did is they gave you a right to an interlocutory appeal to police officers if their motions are denied on clearly on whether the case should be dismissed. Which means before you ever get to the trial, which also means before you ever get to the stage where you might be able to negotiate a settlement, you not only have to beat the motion to dismiss, but you may have to defend an appeal on a motion to dismiss, which, among other things, greatly raises the obstacles to getting an attorney to take your case. Because unless you got a really obvious case, you know, attorneys don't necessarily want to invest that much, because the plaintiffs tend not to be able to pay the attorneys for their time.
Right.
So it's completely bullshit. The last thing I want to say before you ask me a question is this only applies to the civil causes of action. This doesn't apply, for example, to criminal prosecutions as to what violates the Constitution or not, although generally that's not the issue unless it's a civil rights prosecution of the type that the Department of Justice used to bring but completely stopped bringing under Trump when the local municipality refuses to prosecute. Okay. That's the brief summation. It wasn't that brief.
No. I appreciate, and I can see that our audience appreciated, because we had some comments while you were going, and Warren, thank you. I guess there's a lot of different directions you can go in, but I think we're going to take it in the way of coming up with solutions, right, and what steps we might be able to take to end this lack of accountability. I'm a police abolitionist, which means I'd like to scrap what we've got and do something in a different way. But I know that that's a project that's not going to, it's going to take generations. So it's not something that we can really, you know, get into. But I guess one of the things in the way of solutions are understanding how this can be ended. And from what I'd like to know is the impact, first off, on the criminal side of it. You touched on it a little bit, because it's hard to retain an attorney. But what are the wider impacts you feel on criminal law because of this lack of accountability on the civil side that you spoke of?
Well, it doesn't have a direct impact on criminal law. I mean, it shows that police can get away with a lot and no one's going to go after them. But if a police officer is charged under the criminal law, they're charged under the same standards as any other defendant. It's the same things that have to be proved and the same elements. Like in the Derek Chauvin trial, which everybody's been paying a lot of attention to, all those issues were purely issues of the Minnesota criminal law. There is a federal criminal statute for prosecuting someone who deprives someone of civil rights under color of state law. Qualified immunity has nothing to do with that. Qualified immunity has nothing to do with that.
All right, I appreciate it. So we need to, you know, make a distinction in there, and that clears it up. So I appreciate that. In the way of, you had mentioned that there's a lot of levels at which this can be solved. And let's do a for instance, I think will be helpful in my understanding, and maybe our audience's understanding. Let's do a for instance that you're on a city council in a town in New Jersey, and you decide that you want to hold police more accountable. You want to remove qualified immunity. What could be proposed? What could be passed at that city level that might, you know, can create those conditions?
Well, you could begin by passing an ordinance which requires police officers to comply with the Constitution, period, without regard to qualified immunity, and which says that if it is determined that an officer has violated the requirements of the Constitution, they must be discharged, for example. Now, that doesn't help the plaintiff directly, but it might go a long way to changing the actions of the police officers, who are going to be more concerned, and it may go a long way to get the police department to do better training of its officers so that they're not coming close. Okay? Now, it's unlikely that a municipality is going to pass a statute that's going to increase its own liability under a municipal ordinance. But a state legislature had. I mean, a good example might be in New Jersey, where we have our own civil rights law that's similar to Section 1983, which says, you know, if a state person, you know, a governmental official violates either your state or federal constitutional rights, you can sue them. Well, they can amend that law and say, you know, there's no qualified immunity under here. They didn't write qualified immunity into it, but the New Jersey Supreme Court has adopted something damn similar, although not as extreme as what we have in the federal courts for it. And you know, there actually is movement on that front in New Jersey. I mean, the current Attorney General Graywall is making some significant reforms in the area of police accountability. And there's a lot that can be done on the local level for accountability. You get back to the municipal level, municipalities need to consistently push for civilian review boards and real accountability for their officers, and make sure that the citizens who are harmed, or even that people who are harmed, I shouldn't use the word citizens, because Constitution by its terms apply to every person in the jurisdiction. So the persons harmed by their officers have meaningful avenues of getting some sort of police accountability.
So going back to 60s, 70s, probably earlier, that I maybe efforts that I'm not aware of, but I'm aware of, you know, many efforts going throughout the decades of civilian review boards. We talked a couple of weeks ago on the Idavox report, as a matter of fact, about Rudy Giuliani and how he started basically race riots in New York City over the attempts to implement civilian review boards. And right there on the front of every effort to oversee the police are police unions. And we saw, you know, the extremes. There's been extreme examples of resistance. I don't want to narrow it down to one, but, you know, using that example of New York City, we saw police riot on their own government as a result of this attempt at accountability. So, you know, I do have some more questions about solutions. But, of course, as you try to implement solutions, you're always going to run into opposition. And when you run into opposition, one, the strength of police unions, you really got to have some good resources and some real strategy to move forward.
Well, it's a political issue, but the fact is that since George Floyd's death, which, however ineptly Speaker Pelosi put it, there has been real progress and real change and real erosion in the power of the police unions. So organizing can lead to change. And it's amazing how far we've come in the last year on all of these issues in comparison to where we were before George Floyd's murder. Now, I'm not suggesting that a lot of more people get murdered by the police, but also the fact is that there's so much greater scrutiny now every time it happens. And the police are starting to complain that people don't want to come to work for them anymore, that they're having trouble recruiting people, that all sorts of police officers are retiring because they're ashamed to tell people that they're police officers when they're home on the weekend or they're in a bar. This is what makes the change. This is what's going to make the change. And it's stop giving in to fear. You know, what Giuliani and what Trump and all those people do is they sell fear and white privilege. I'll tell you, there was a story that just popped up in the New York Times today that might have a blow on white privilege, feeling they're not immune from police. Out in Colorado, in Loveland, Colorado, a 73-year-old white woman with dementia went into a Walmart, and she apparently walked out with $13 worth of stuff that she forgot to pay for. She didn't. They confronted her, and she gave the stuff back. They took the stuff from her, and they refused to take her money. She offered to pay. They just took the stuff from her, but apparently then she took the mask. I guess she's a Trumpist at heart. She took the mask. She ripped the mask off the Walmart worker's face who was talking to her. So Walmart then called the police. And you can question that. So the police come, but the charge is that at worst she stole $13.22 worth of merchandise, and she ripped the mask off an employee. She's confused. She stops when they tell her to stop. She says she's going home, and she's walking away from them. And she keeps saying, I'm just trying to go home, and she's walking away from them. They grab her. They throw her on the ground. They break her arm. They dislocate her shoulder. They put her in jail for hours without medical care.
What the fuck?
And it's all on video. So now when this video, which I suspect is going viral now while we speak, while this video is circulated and they filed a lawsuit, maybe things like that are going to get through to the white power in this country, that you're not immune either. Police are simply out of control. A 73-year-old white woman with dementia, they beat up for over $13.
Yeah. I think there's, I mean, we do have to acknowledge the disproportional policing.
Oh, no, there's no question. But you were asking me what might make change. You were asking me what might make change.
You know, I'd like to, well, you know, I would say that maybe that's it, but I won't take away from the marches in the streets and the millions of people that erupted, you know, upon the death of George Floyd. And I think that goes to his memory, you know, and, you know, and the organizers and the people in the streets and the Black Lives Matter and the people that did Instagram posts and didn't allow the narrative to die down. I think for a good long couple of months, the sustained protest. And, you know, Bennett, I hear a lot of
it's organizers. Still sustained. Look at all the new protests that broke right? out over
the man. It's not. It keeps going. And for, you know, that you, like you said, we've known each other a while now. 15 now started quite a while ago. You know, I heard plenty of older organizers with far more experience than me say we need to get more people in the streets. This isn't a movement unless we can get people out in the streets. And I think that, you know, I can mark to it a couple of times in my life prior, but the George Floyd case and the activism and the organizing that sprung out of it was definitely unique in my lifetime.
It's unique in everybody's lifetime. It's nobody never been anything about like
people not being in the streets for the first fucking time in my life. Yeah. Like people, everybody was out in the streets, and look what happened. I mean, we did get a little better result. I don't want to have to march in the street for months every time just to hold police accountable. Something that should be done and done by a quote unquote justice system, and one that I know you're overly familiar with this country's definition of justice.
The problem is that the justice system is a system that has to be changed, and you can't rely on it to change itself unless there's constant pressure.
Yeah, I agree.
It's the only reason that Derek Chauvin was arrested in the first place. He would never have been arrested had there not been protests in the street across the country, across the world, and all of the unrest that went on in Minneapolis.
And had there not been that young woman, and had there not been that young woman who took such a video, all those bystanders, I mean, they really do deserve credit. Because she wasn't the only one who videotaped.
Absolutely.
And you can hear on her videotape how they're all yelling at him. You know, stop it. You're killing this person. Why are you killing this person?
And they were threatening her. And
he's not resisting anymore. You hear all those things on the tape.
Yeah, Warren has been on the chat. Thanks for helping us out tonight. Warren, I always appreciate people being on our live stream chat and says, you know, the law doesn't just allow police brutality, it justifies it. And I think that, you know, Bennett, your explanation definitely validates that opinion somewhat. But we, like I said, I wanted to ask, and I did ask a little bit more on a local level. You talked about what states can do. What do you think? And you generally have a better view of the administration than I do. What do you think can be done or should be done on a federal level? Let's just take, for example, there was a statement made immediately after the verdict. I don't know if you had a chance to watch Vice President Kamala Harris and President Biden made statements. Do you feel like their rhetoric and what they're saying is leading us down the right direction? What are they not saying that you feel needs to be said from that high chair of power in government?
I think considering the positions that they hold, what they're saying is very positive. I mean, they're pushing for the passage of this George Floyd Act that passed Congress. And although it doesn't have everything that somebody might want, it does quite a bit. And if we could get that, that seems to be something that is building some real political support. You know, I think as politicians, as elected officials, they have to be realistic. But with that act, they're definitely pushing the boundaries of what might be attainable. So, you know, I think they're doing well on the political front. You know, in a dream world, if I thought we could have the ideal statute, there's a lot more than is in that statute. But if you had asked me 2 years ago, whether it would be possible to get those things through Congress anytime soon, in that you would have the president of the United States, and forget that it's Trump, assume it wasn't Trump, endorsing changes in the law like that, I would have told you were crazy.
Yeah. Let me ask Belisha. I do, for our podcast listeners who can't see it, we will note. I don't know exactly how you identify, but Belisha is the only not white guy in the room tonight. So I think that's important. Isn't it? It's important to perspective to understand the difference when we ask things of our officials, right? And that's all the only reason I let our podcast know.
All right. In all honesty, though, I like to say that I identify as Jewish rather than white.
Jewish.
Because okay, the people who are the white supremacists don't include Jews anyway.
Thank
so
you.
So I don't see why I should include myself with that group.
All right. So I'm the only white guy in the room. I'll take it. And I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Well, the world views me as white, and I enjoy a tremendous amount of white privilege.
There
I'm
you
not,
go.
You know, in the context, in that context, I'm white.
We always let people identify as they wish on Revolution Radio. You get to tell us how you identify, and I'm not trying to tell anybody. But that's why I try to frame it that way, you know.
Okay.
Belisha, so getting to the question though, what do you see from our government officials? What are you happy with, and what is not being seen or being said that you might like to hear from Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, or senators?
I do think that Joe Biden and the administration, they're getting a lot of very good coaching on these things. They're trying to draw a very sharp distinction between themselves and the last administration. And, you know, I don't think that on their own, without these movements taking place, they would have, you know, said things as clearly and as forcefully as they have, which I'm very happy with. They're taking the temperature of the room, and they're saying a lot of things that I really was not expecting from them. So I'm pretty happy about that. They're kind of hitting the nail on the head right now and striking the right tone and, you know, addressing all of the chief concerns that people have about these things.
It's another chance for Joe Biden to show how calm he can be.
The politicians, you know, and I'm a lawyer too, to some extent, it's, you know, it's in the nature of my profession. You're trying to do the best for the cause you're advancing that you can do, given the current state of the law, or in the case of a politician, given the current politics. Now, they need that anger to make the change. But in the case of coming after Trump, one of the things about Biden's calmness is I think as it goes on, it's going to calm down all these Trump crazies. And we really do have to get those people to calm down and stop being as militant as they are. The fact is that for the past 40 years, since Ronald Reagan, the right and the extreme right has done a better job getting people in the streets, done a better job expressing their militance, getting a better job pushing the politicians to their point of view than the left has. And I think we need the left, and I think we need it to be as militant and as strong as possible and to be as angry as possible. But we shouldn't scoff at the progress that we're making. We have to celebrate the progress that we're making when we get people like Joe Biden to go as far as he has. And what we got to do is our best to make sure we're able to collect our winnings. Not that we leave our table, but at least we're sure that we actually have the chips. I mean, the George Floyd bill may have been endorsed by the President of the United States, and it may have passed the House of Representatives, but it hasn't passed the Senate yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have to get it there. And we got to continue the anger in the streets. Belisha's 100% right that that's what needed for real change is the anger in the streets. But you know, we have to work with the people who are there. We gotta give them credit when they deserve it.
There are a lot of chants out that they're true. The people divided can never be defeated.
Problem is the people united can never be defeated, but I've yet to see them united.
We're working on it. Don't be so
yes, we
cynical
are.
Yet. Don't be so cynical. We've gotten things done, and I think this is an example where things are getting done. I don't want to tell anybody that it's done, but we're working on it. And I see forward progress. I see forward progress. And I don't want to knock any organizers right now by saying, well, it's not good enough, which is kind of my mantra a lot of times. But no, I'm not going to do that because I was there. I was on the streets. I was part of it. I am personally, I don't want to say like, I don't know how to express how I feel about the results of our collective work. Because it's about George Floyd and it's about him and his family. But I know there's a lot of organizers that work very hard, and it's this verdict and the subsequent movements that we all take part in are all a part of that collective work. It may have started with George Floyd, but it's left to us to continue on these movements. And that's what really affects change. We gotta go, but I'm going to give you each couple, like a minute or two, if you got another thought. And of course, tell us where you want us to send money if you've got any charity work or anything going on. Please feel free. And let's start with Belicia, our editorial member, editorial board. Let me start that over again. I can edit. Our editorial board member out of Florida. Last thoughts.
I just think, you know, I think everyone was struck by the verdict. Obviously, when I watched it, it was very like anticlimactic, it was very monotone. You know, yeah, all that passion is out in the streets, and I felt it when I watched it. Everyone else was feeling it. But when it comes down to like actually the things that need to get done, it's very matter of fact, and it's very cold. And but that doesn't mean that the forces behind it aren't just as dynamic or, you know, forceful and passionate. And that's what we're here to do. The judge is there. The jurors are there to just, you know, state very matter of fact things. That's what Joe Biden is doing. You know, these leaders, it's up to us, the people, to put that heart and that soul and that work into it.
I got to ask Belicia before she goes, do you have a short list of things to review for next month? Is it going to be another movie?
Or sure. Don't... Yeah. I mean, it could be anything. Could be. But yeah, I do love movies.
So. I do like movies here. I do too. So hey, if you're interested in helping out and getting involved with us and reviewing things and letting, or just letting me know your thoughts, message us some stuff on either Instagram, Facebook, or you can email us info@njrevolutionradio.com and maybe suggest some films. I'd love to have some independent artists out there that are trying to get their work and give you a little platform here.
Yes, please. Musicians, writers.
And let's do it. I need to do some organizing with our artistic community. That's what I need.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, because I really enjoy these conversations, and we'll see you next month. All right. And Bennett, before we let you go, last thoughts.
All right. Well, my final thought is on the issue we've been discussing, celebrate the victories and keep pushing and keep working for more, because it is a long bite and the job is far from being done. In terms of where maybe people should send some money, I'm constantly urging people to send money to the groups working on climate change, like 350.org, Sunshine, Greenpeace. On issues of police accountability, I like to support the People's Organization for Progress in New Jersey, the group that Larry Hamm leads, and on a national level, I think Color of Change is probably the best politically active lobbying group on the national scene.
All right. So again, that's Bennett Zarofsky. He's out of New Jersey again. Thank you so much, Bennett, for all your support as an editorial board member. And I always got to mention, Bennett represents activists like a billion times pro bono when they get into trouble trying to get social justice work done. And he's just a treasure to the New Jersey activist community. So Bennett, thank you for everything you've done for us here. And we look forward to speaking with you again about more legal stuff very, very soon.
You're welcome.
All right. To my audience, my editorial board, everybody out there, thank you. I mean, I had some fun this week. Next week, NJRR Live will be back as we come back every Wednesday at 8 p.m. We're also going to have the Idavox report Tuesdays at 8 p.m. It's pretty easy to remember, right? You want to check us out. Make sure you subscribe to YouTube, like the Facebook page,
get in on. Go to www.njrevolutionradio.com. Become a member. Make sure you get on our email list. You know, get into this thing, man. We need your support. I love the comments on the stream. It's actually starting to pile up a little bit where I don't get to comment on all the comments. But I promise you that I read them all. And, you know, it means a lot to me that you all are checking us out. This is Brian Powers. And until next week, I want everybody to remember that the police can quit their jobs. Good night, everybody.